sabrosura pa ti que.
Hello, everyone. This is Pam, de Café con Pam, the bilingual podcast that features Latine and people of the global majority who break barriers and change lives and make this world a better place. Welcome to episode 338 of Café con Pam. Today, we have a conversation with Ed Vargas. Ed is an international speaker, author, consultant with executive marketing sales experience in the packaging industry, a former editor, publisher, and international conference director for B2B Non-Owners Publishing Group, and has led and collaborated with nonprofit community groups that make a positive difference. After 10 years of digital program management with AT&T's e-commerce group, Ed's passionate about the ethical and humane use of tech for social good impacts. Ed has been a proactive change maker throughout his career with education, leadership programs, employee resource groups, representation, marketing, communications, and strategic planning. He was first in his family to attend college with a BSc and JD from Santa Clara University, executive management publishing programs at Cornell, and Northwestern's Medill School of Journalism. Ed's current roles include president of Vargas & Associates LLC, an empowering social impact innovation consulting group, Northwest Region President HLX Plus, a national 501c6 Hispanic community impact group, head of the Latinx and Employee Resource Group practice CTR Factor Inc., mentor Miller Center for Social Entrepreneurship, Santa Clara University, Community Leadership Advisory Board, Latinx Research Center, Santa Clara University, and Ed is also a lifelong musician who plays guitar and lives with his wife, Christine, in Contra Costa County, California. Listeners, Ed is amazing. He is so wise and brings so much to our conversation. I have known Ed for a few years now. We have met in person a couple of times, and we've been in various groups collaborating in different ways, and he always brings so much to the table, and I wanted to bring him on for a while, and I think you'll enjoy this conversation. I really hope you do, because Ed has a lot to share. Y bueno, listeners, sin más, here's my conversation with Mr. Ed Vargas. Mr. Ed, welcome to Café con Pam. How are you?
Pam, it's great to be with you.
Yes.
One of these days we'll be in the same room together.
Yes, it's happened sporadically in the last few years, and it's great because you bring so much wisdom into the room, and I'm excited to have you today. So the first question that we always ask is, what's your heritage?
I actually had my DNA checked. So with Vargas and Martinez, I figured, okay, I'm going to have Mexican heritage. But then I also found that in addition to that, coming from Spain, I've got Spain, I've got Basque, as well as from the Scandinavian countries. And there's an element of African-American countries in my background, too.
Wow.
So my maternal grandmother, my dad's side, she was an indigenous Yaqui Native American. So
Okay. That's
in my blood, too. So I'm so happy to have seen it's more than just my last name. And one of the things that I appreciated growing up is that I didn't really move around a lot. Before it became Silicon Valley, I lived in Santa Clara Valley in San Jose, and we didn't travel a lot. So that was one of the things that as I grew up, that became a bigger priority for me, is to visit other countries and be in their hometown and see from their perspective what their culture is like. And that, to me, was a way that, you know, we're all human beings and we can relate to each other in so many different ways.
Totally. So you mentioned already that you grew up in what is now called NorCal. Did your parents arrive there? Are you first, second, third gen?
My dad was born in Santa Barbara. My mom in the San Jose area. And my dad was a World War II veteran.
Okay.
One of his friends that he met coming back was my mom's brother. And so he met my mom through his friend in the military. And that was one of the elements that I grew up with, is that my dad was an Army Air Force veteran. He flew over 50 missions based in North Africa and Italy. And that connection that he saw or that I felt that I had seen him with other veterans. It's just a brotherhood. You know, when you're in the military, you know, and you go on these dangerous missions, you may not even come back. You have to depend on the person next to you. And that to me is was one of the key elements of me growing up in my family, is that you stick up for each other, you help each other. If you see somebody in need, you have each other's back, is kind of an expression that it used to be popular. So that's just been a core element of my dad. He actually started the first Hispanic Veterans Association group called the Regular Veterans there in San Jose. And my mom became president of the auxiliary. So the women, mostly the wives of those veterans, they helped in community outreach, you know, fundraisers, dances, just helping the community at large.
That's awesome. Their parents, did they migrate? When did the migration come, or was it more of the border crossed them?
My grandfather, Felipe Vargas, was in Mexico. When I grew up with him, he was in his late 80s, so he was bedridden. I would only see him when my dad would visit him, and I would listen to their conversations in Spanish. I didn't really understand Spanish because I grew up in a time where assimilation was kind of the priority. Mm-hmm. So that was the experience I had with both my grandfathers. I did not have any grandmothers alive when I grew up. So that was kind of the feeling that I had. It was certainly you respect your elders, but I didn't really have a lot of communication with my dad's grandfather because he only spoke Spanish. And my mother's father, my grandfather Martinez, if you look at the history of San Jose, you would find that there's a park called Alum Rock Park. Well, he was kind of a general contractor. If you go up and look at the fountains up in that park, he actually helped build those back in the day. And then they now have a special area set aside for really iconic things that were saved from San Jose. And back in the day, they had a tower with one leg of each tower on each of the four corners of a particular street in downtown area. And he helped build that as well.
So cool.
So they are talking about that as a historical site. And actually, at some point, there have been these conversations about putting it back in downtown San Jose. But it's good to know that we are rooted. We have our roots there in San Jose. And my grandfather had something to do with that on the Martinez side.
Totally. How cool. So born and raised in NorCal, Santa Clara, San Jose, like all around those areas. Did you ever leave for school or anything? Because you traveled, but what was the first time?
So when I got, let me go back to a moment in junior high school. So I was always an active reader. I loved reading. You know, we didn't have cell phones and videos in those days. So I would kind of look at scientific information. I would look at creative information by reading. And that got me really good grades in school. And I was very athletic. I played all sports. So one teacher told me, you know, you're student body president. You're in the eighth grade. Why don't you apply to a Jesuit all-boys Catholic school here? It's called Bellarmine College Prep. And to be quite honest, I hadn't even heard of the school at the time. But I'd learned a little about it. I spoke to my parents. It's a tuition school. So that was going to be different for me. But I was accepted. And when I got into Santa Clara, I got into this spirit of being a Jesuit, having that kind of education. They really emphasize having compassion for other people and learning, become a lifelong learner your whole life. So those core principles for me kind of got me through school. And then I applied to several colleges and I was accepted at all of them. I had a chance to take advantage of a full scholarship at St. Mary's College in Moraga.
Hold on, before you go into that, given that you had a military dad, was that an avenue that you considered? Like, all right, if dad was in the military, do I go take that path, or was always education a priority?
When I was a freshman at that time, there was the Vietnam War, and I got a college a deferment because I was enrolled in college. But I also enrolled in the ROTC Army unit there too, because I thought if I was going to be drafted, I wanted to go in as an officer, not just an enlisted man. So yes, it was a very it was a thoughtful process for me. Whether or not I'd be drafted, I didn't know, but I did have cousins that were drafted, and that's how I kind of approached it.
Whoa. like we're taking a pause in your story because that knowing that you lived through those times during the Vietnam War, going through what's happening right now in the world, how are you seeing it? What's your perspective?
Well, one of the things that it's been one of my drivers, just going back to high school for a moment, is that, yes, I did have a chance to go play football for 4 years and have all my expenses covered for school, but I needed to have an operation on my knee. I had tendons that had to be taken care of and cartilage removed.
How did the knee injury happen?
It just during playing football for 4 years, that was just something that...
So it was like wear and tear?
Yeah, wear and tear. So I thought, well, if I can take care of that, boy, I'll be the first in my family to go to college and all my costs will be taken care of. It would be pretty cool. But having been home for about 2 weeks, all of a sudden I couldn't breathe. And so they rushed me to the hospital and they put me in an oxygen tent while they were doing tests. And about 36 hours there, I could barely breathe. I couldn't sleep. All I could do was try to stay awake to catch my next half breath. And when they came back with the diagnosis, it was the fact that I had blood clots in my knee that left from that surgery. And those blood clots had actually passed through my heart as opposed to causing a heart attack. So it was a pulmonary embolism.
Was it because you were young?
I was in the best shape of my life. I actually, one of the reasons I got selected for this scholarship is that I played first string offensive guard and first string defensive tackle. So I didn't get off the field once the game started. I just enjoyed it. I tried to do the best for my team and I was able to play first string on both sides. So that was, you know, just something to me that I took pride in. But in that moment, they're trying to decide what it was that I have. Here I am at, you know, 17 years old, and I don't even know if I'm going to get out of this bed alive or not. So I did set at that point some life goals for myself. Because I hadn't traveled a lot, I wanted to do some international travel if I had the opportunity later on in my career. I just set a target. I said, whatever organization I'm at, I want to be a senior executive by the age of 30 in that organization. And if I can get out of this hospital and get my health back, I will look forward to paying it forward as best I can for people throughout my whole life. So that was those were goals that I set for myself. And we can talk about it later, but I met all those goals.
How long did it take for you to recover?
The actual diagnosis was they just gave me a blood thinner. And they, while I was still in the hospital, they gave it to me 4 times a day.
Whoa.
I was there for about 2 more weeks. And then I was on pills for a blood thinner for a couple of months, but that resolved the issue. But that was something that I considered, like, do I really want to play football and put myself potentially in a situation like that again? And I thought, well, I've been accepted to all the schools that I applied to. Yeah. So instead of going to the East Bay where St. Mary's is at, I went to Santa Clara University, which was literally like a mile from my high school. And I had the decision that I wanted to do the best I could to get a college degree, be the first in my family to do that. So that was a motivating factor. But that meant that, yes, I had an academic scholarship that covered quite a bit of the tuition, but any additional costs I'd have to, you know, pick up on my own. So that's one of the ways I made money, was playing in a band back in those days. My brother played drums and I played guitar. And that was a good source of income. We even played for, at those days, the military bases were around. Mm. We had Moffett Field. We had the Oak Knoll Naval Hospital in Oakland, and then we had Treasure Island in San Francisco. So there were enlisted men and officers clubs that the band that we were in at the time, we would be playing the weekends there, and I could make $40 an hour at a minimum compared to $4 or $5 an hour, you know, working in the library at school or something.
That's a pretty good pay for a college student.
Yeah, as a college student. So I also, you know, part-time during the summer. And those days, they, you know, we had, it wasn't Silicon Valley full of tech company buildings. It was orchards. There was a cannery in Northern California. They would bring in fruit from around all of the area, peaches, cherries, and those kinds of things. And I was a forklift driver at a cannery, California Canners and Growers. That also paid well in driving a forklift. So those types of jobs, but during the summertime, sometimes those were 6 days a week.
Wow.
And sometimes even 7 days a week, because they had to work with the fruit as soon as it was ripe. They had to can it at that point in time. So, you know, driving, unloading a truck, putting it in the ice house, and then they'd check the condition of all the types of fruit that we had. And then I would bring them out based on what they told us that was going to be canned that day. So that was something that hard work just became, you know, part of the routine. And that did limit the time I had to study.
I was going to say, when do you get everything done?
Yeah, I didn't have as much time as everybody else had, but, you know, especially if you're playing at a club or an event and you get through at 1 o'clock or 1:30 in the morning and you pack up your gear and then you have to go home, that was a different timetable too. Fortunately, Santa Clara University in those days, they were on a quarter system. So we would have Wednesdays off, which meant that you'd cover just as much content, but you would do it in a shorter period of time. So it just made me really, you know, try to focus as best I could.
What was your undergrad in? How did you decide?
Actually, from that experience that I had in high school, I started as I was going to be a psychology major. I wanted to understand, again, from a perspective of people facing challenges, what that would be like. But as I got into those courses, the feeling that I had was it became more clinical than I thought it would be, which was fine if you really wanted to be in counseling psychology. But that's where I thought, well, I think I'm going to shift to the business school and focus on marketing. So I got a double major. I had enough credits to get a major in marketing and business administration from the Levy School of Business.
Fun. And then what happened?
Again, you know, I thought, well, no one in my family has had a college degree. You know, what if I got another degree here? So I started saving up money to go to law school. Santa Clara Law School was, you know, had a great reputation at the time. And again, you know, how do I get the money to do this? So I went to work playing in a band, and I managed a clothing store, a retail clothing store in San Jose as well. And it was helpful because the clothes that we wore in the band, I could get discounts for all the band members because I was the manager. It was fun too, because we would learn back in the day, it wasn't YouTube or how do you learn how to play this song? It's like you had to figure it out on your own.
And how did you promote?
Well, we had a booking agent at the time.
Nice.
So we shifted from booking our own gigs. Once we got to that level, the agency was called the Don Owens Agency. And he had promo shots of us. And we would play in those days. It's not like one night a week at a club. You were the house band and you'd play 5 nights a week. Well, we'd be doing it 5 nights a week, a month at a time. And if they liked us, they'd book us for the next month as well.
So cool. And how was it for young Ed, kind of like coordinating and prioritizing your school? Because I bet it was super fun to get these gigs as a band player. And so how did you stay focused on your school?
Well, that goes, again, my nature, and I've had this tested several different times, but by nature, I'm an analytical driver. So if I have an assignment or a project and I commit to take it on, I will do everything I possibly can to make sure it's successful. And that's just how I've approached everything. So I didn't hang around I even had roommates, but I wasn't at the parties that we would go and have a keg of beer someplace. I'd be playing at a gig that night, you know. So the nickname I had with my roommates senior year in college, I was Dad because of that work profile.
That's so funny. Then you go into law school. Why law school?
You know, one of the things that I saw, particularly with, for example, the veterans organization that my dad started, I didn't know it at the time, but as I got older, one of the things that came across was that at the national level of these veterans, there were veterans that were from the Deep South. And those guys grew up, you know, when the African-American people are supposed to drink it from a different water fountain.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Hispanics were also thrown into that same bucket. And my dad wanted to start a veterans organization. So rather than, you know, having issues with all those kinds of things, he basically said, well, let's start the first Hispanic group focus. So to me, I kind of grew up with this feeling that we're all human beings. And my dad, you know, put his life on the line 50 times. And the veterans that appreciated that, who were in similar situations, they all were like family. They all stood up for each other. So that to me was a core energy of mine, is that, you know, whatever the challenge was, I was going to do the best I possibly could.
And how did you figure law school was the avenue?
From my perspective, I wanted to give people that didn't have a voice, an actual, you know, voice to deal with some of these issues. So because some people don't have access to knowing what the rules are, regulations, you know, they get swept away. For many years, even now, I'm involved with, you know, at one point I was driving a forklift at a cannery from the fruit that was coming in. And I was thinking, you know, I'm really tired after a 12-hour day driving a forklift. But how tired would those farm workers be out in the fields where they had to, you know, get these crops and put them in the containers that were coming to me? So to me, there are people that, because of redlining rules that were in California and many states across the country, similar to, you know, when people want to enable themselves to change the rules at their choice that has a negative impact for everybody else, but great for them, you know, just again, thinking about things like manifest destiny. When I grew up, there was this phrase meaning that the Europeans coming over, landing from the Mayflower, it was their divine right to take over the land from indigenous people. And now they have a treaty and you need to live on this reservation. And heroes of mine, because of football and an amazing athlete like Jim Thorpe, you know, he went to Carlisle School. And at Carlisle, they basically stripped you of your heritage, your indigenous heritage, and recommended you learn everything in English and dress this way and change your life. And to me, for people that have a culture that they can relate to, it's important that they feel comfortable in any situation. So that was one of the reasons that I tried to go to law school. The challenge I had was that after my first year, full time, and it was this 3-year program at Santa Clara, unfortunately, my mom, we found that she had cancer. And her whole life, she smoked cigarettes. And at that time, they didn't really know the dangers of cigarettes. So she had been smoking for 37 years, and then she developed throat cancer.
Wow.
And then just a few months after that, my dad had a heart attack.
Oh, my gosh.
So here I am, you know, working in a band and going to law school, and I had to change my priorities because, again, familia is the foundation for everything that I do. Mm-hmm. So I changed my approach. Rather than increasing my debt and being a law student, I shifted gears and I went to work for a company in the packaging industry, and they had a program that they would pay for my law school education. They would pay a certain percentage of that. So I could still complete law school, but I would change from, instead of the day curriculum, I would go to the night division. So it took me a little bit longer because I couldn't take as many courses at night as I would have if I dedicated the whole day to it. But it also gave me balance at that time to spend time with my parents and try to help them as best they could while I was still working toward my goals. To me, it made sense. It's something that I wanted to do. Whether I was going to be an attorney or not, mm-hmm. and in that moment, I wanted to get the degree. I set that goal for myself to achieve that. I was working toward that goal. So I just changed the process. So as I'm still able to reach my goal.
I love that because you got a couple of detours or bumps in the road or whatever you want to call it, and you still chose to complete the goal that you had given yourself and still allowing the journey to be a little bit different than what you had planned, but still not losing sight of what the ultimate objective was. That's really cool.
It was even a challenge too, because then I started dating my current wife. And at that time, unfortunately, her mom passed.
Oh my gosh.
Literally within 90 days, my mom passed. So that put off, you know, when we were talking about getting married, we both had to deal with those kinds of issues. And in a sense, it bonded us even stronger together. So this past September, we celebrated our 44th year being married. So it's, again, something to me is that family is a foundation, and you need to kind of think through what those challenges are and do the best you can. For me, at that time when I was growing up, it was my parents, that was my family. But then again, after we lost my mom, and then my dad, you know, again, a veteran, and he had these heart attacks. He lost about 70% of his vision from his second heart attack. So, but he was with us a little bit longer. So all those things I'm just sharing with you is that, you know, we all face struggles in our life. I turned those moments and wanted to continue helping students. And we can talk a little bit later about, you know, starting the High Tech Day program at AT&T. But I walked through with students to have them use my college career strategic planning tool and explain to them some of the challenges that I just shared with you, how I work through those. And if you have a vision and you want to be someplace in 5 years, you can put a plan together to get there.
Totally. Let's take a quick coffee break. Okay, Ed, do you drink coffee?
Yes, I do. I drink coffee and tea. Yeah.
How do you drink your coffee?
I don't drink a lot of it. First thing in the morning after I'm taking my vitamins, I have a half a cup of coffee, and that's kind of it for the day. If I'm out someplace traveling, you know, and I'm in a different time zone, then yes, I'll stop at a Starbucks or someplace local where I can pick up coffee there. But coffee, that little bit of caffeine in the morning certainly is helpful.
For sure.
To me, food is a special element. Food, coffee, and however you want to combine those things, it's a way to connect with people, just sharing a meal together. My wife, I teased her. I said I married into a family of foodies. So, you know, they enjoy the experience of going to a new restaurant, trying things out. And that even makes the food taste better for me when I see other people talking about the preparation of it, what goes into it, put this spice into it versus that spice, and they'll eat it and they'll say, you know, the next time I'm going to make this myself. So that's something when we were talking earlier about the kind of workload that I had going to school and working and trying to get my degrees and the situations, I didn't really have the time to, you know, prepare my own meals and, you know, just make it a festive kind of occasion. So when I have those opportunities now and I'm with people that enjoy food, it makes it even better for me now.
Yeah, it's great breaking bread together and enjoying conversation. The idea of Café con Pan is for us to sit down and have a cup of coffee, but, you know, geography, so we're pretending. But yes, I concur. I think breaking bread together is a great form of engaging, having conversation, building bonds, and just like seeing the humanity of each other.
To that point, so there is a phrase called mirroring. And when I was in sales, when I first started, you know, again, this first job that I had while I was still going to law school at night, I would be traveling in California, Oregon, Washington with my clients. And one of the things that I learned, especially when I'd be traveling to other states in the Midwest and wherever, if you eat the food or eat the beverages of the people that you're meeting for the first time, whether they're clients or other potential people to collaborate, there's a connection that you can make with them because you're eating what they enjoy, their favorite meal. So I was always interested in trying new things. So that was just something that I would order what they ordered and see what their local favorites were. And that was a bond, for example. When I went to later on, we can talk about, I was recruited to get into the nonwovens publishing business, and I had a chance to travel internationally to Japan. And we can talk a little bit about how that happened. But tasting food in Japan in restaurants that were made there, there's even a distinction between if you eat at a Japanese restaurant or a Chinese restaurant here, I've been told, well, that's not Chinese food. The only Chinese food is if you're in China eating it there. So it's you're dealing with those kinds of issues as well. And so I just totally kind of go with the flow, kind of mirror that feeling and want to experience from their perspective what they like. And that broadens my understanding and the ability to collaborate with people as well.
I agree 100%. On my end, I want to give a shout out to a local business in San Diego called Hell Yeah Helena. or Elena. I'm not sure yet. I haven't met them yet. This weekend, I'm going to an event where they make empanadas. And so I'm going to go try their empanadas. But I wanted to give them a shout out since I'll be tasting them this weekend. I'm sure they're delicious. But let's get back to the show. Hola, Vanis. By the way, if you are enjoying this conversation and you want to keep talking about it, if you have some comments and maybe some questions that you have, follow me on social media and let's keep that conversation going. This is your reminder to screenshot and tag me at Café con Pan Podcast on Instagram and Facebook. And let's keep talking about it. Tell me what's resonating. Tell me what isn't. Tell me what do you wish I asked the guest. This is your chance. And if you're on TikTok, I'm at Café con Pan Pod as well. Let's stay connected. So Ed, we're going to fast forward a little bit because I want you to tell me when you met your goal of being an executive before the age of 30. How did that happen?
Well, I went to work for a very, very large company called Owens, Illinois at the time in the packaging business. And there was a competitor, a regional competitor, that recruited me to take over their product development area. And then a couple of months after I was there, like less than 6 months, the biggest customer of that second company was Colgate-Palmolive. So we were a major supplier to their Berkeley facility where they produce their products. But then we were told that their plan was to shut down their Berkeley operation and relocate their production for the West Coast to Kansas City. So they gave us a year's notice saying, you know, they're going to take their business away. So thank you very much. But that's how they were going to handle it. The VP of marketing and sales for that company said, I'm not going to be able to do that. So I'm gone. So we did lose some senior executives, but truly after going through Levy School of Business and looking at the situation, I thought, you know, if I want to challenge myself, if I want to see how good I really am, I'm going to turn this around. So I worked with our manufacturing people and started inviting clients that were in California instead of having their R&D from a packaging perspective with companies like my former company that would, they'd have to go to Ohio. We could do their R&D with them and develop a really strong relationship if they wanted to work with us, who we were in Northern California, north of San Francisco. So with that approach, we not only replaced the business that we were going to lose with Colgate, but the demand was so high. And we also looked at the profitability of the product mix that we had. So by changing our product mix and bringing in new clients that we never had before, we not only replaced the business, but within a year and a half, we had to open a second manufacturing facility in Southern California.
Nice.
And this happened during a recession at the time. So again, with a strategic plan and the way I approached these clients and developed a strong relationship, we were able to bring brand new business we never had that was more profitable to replace, you know, when you're dealing with Colgate-Palmolive, they are looking for the lowest price, typically, those larger companies. We had a better profit margin and actually expanded during a recession. So that's how I got to be VP of Sales and Marketing for that company.
Did you ever doubt yourself? Or are you one of those people that is like, I have a goal, it doesn't matter, whatever, we'll make it happen?
I go back to playing football. you keep trying, and if one thing works or it's getting better. For example, one of the games that we played when I was in high school, I knew that I was going to be playing against this guy that was over 300 pounds and a couple inches taller than me. And I just set my goal that I'm going to do the best I can to play against this. It was going to be a one-on-one pretty much the whole game.
Wow.
And the first part of the game, I felt like I was on roller skates because I couldn't keep him out of our backfield. But because one of the things that playing both ways, offense and defense, gets you in pretty good shape.
Mm-hmm.
So when we come out for the second half, this guy was when he was trying to play with me. And I was just sticking it to him and pushing him back, even though he was, 70 pounds heavier than me.
Wow.
We beat that team. They were rated higher than us. They were ranked in the state. But we beat that team. And again, I was exhausted when that game was over. But the coach came up to me and congratulated. And he said, we didn't know how we were going to be able to protect our quarterback from that particular player. But he really complimented me on the work. So So to me, it's, you know, you try to bear down and work from within in those situations. And one of the drivers for me wasn't just my personal goal to try to turn this around, is that working in that manufacturing plant where we were headquartered at, the families there, they were dependent on having a job. And so that was a driver for me, is just as strong as it was from with my own interest in turning this around, is that I wanted to be sure they still had a job and could take care of their families.
For sure. So we'll go back to 17-year-old Ed. You're like, all right, the goals are here. You know, there's the one where you shared, you know, always giving back. So that's ongoing. But the one to make it to become an executive, it happened. Did you get this sense of like, ooh, I made it. And then what?
Well, okay. So let's put it in perspective. So my dad worked at that cannery that I was at when I was a forklift driver. And he always encouraged me. He said, don't, you know, be caught up in doing what I'm doing. He said, you know, think of what you want to do and go work toward that. So I, you know, here I am working for this very large corporation. And then where I got the executive position when I was 30, that was my second corporate job. But that second corporation, because we became so successful, that was owned by one gentleman. And he saw that as a great opportunity to cash in his company. And it was sold to, if you're familiar with spices, there's a company called McCormick Shilling.
Yeah.
And what they offered was that they would buy all the equipment so that they could make their own packaging for their own products.
Whoa.
So that made sense to the guy who owned the company.
Yep.
So my sense at that time is that because of the success that I had and the background that I had, I got recruited to a larger packaging company there in San Francisco called Crown Zellerbach. And I became a group planner for them. But I left before that second company that I worked for completely shut down and relocated the equipment to Southern California. But what it taught me was is that there's no guarantee for a job. My dad worked at that cannery through his whole life, basically, until he had his heart attack. But from my perspective, I thought that, you know, you have an opportunity to work at a company, and if it meets the needs of your family and it makes sense, that's great. But, you know, it's not a lifetime deal. They could quit, they could change, they could sell. And in those days, too, that company that I went to work for, because they were so successful, they were a target of, back in the day, there were these corporate raiders, and there would be these takeovers, these hostile corporate takeovers. And that's what I experienced with that company. So again, it kind of underlined there's no guarantee mm-hmm. when you work for a company. One of the things that was fortunate is that I was a group controller helping the general managers of five different divisions create their own business plans going forward. One of those divisions was something called non-wovens. And what's a non-woven? Well, if you take a look at the liner in baby diapers or any personal care product, that is made of synthetic fibers. So high level, just like you take cotton or wood fibers and you make paper, it was basically starting with that kind of process. But with synthetic fibers, they made these non-wovens. And that was a really developing industry across the world. And that company, Crown Zellerbach, had a division for that. So because I helped write the group plan and I knew the business, I got recruited by a publishing company that wanted to start a magazine, newsletter, and international business conferences about the nonwovens industry.
And this is before LinkedIn.
Yes.
So.
Yes, it was.
How are they finding out about you?
The same company that got me the interview with the second company that I went to, that I became an executive there, he knocked on my door again and said, because, you know, he's a recruiter, a corporate recruiter mm-hmm. in San Francisco. He said, in the packaging industry, he needs this particular background. So that's how I got into Crown Zellerbach. And then because of my background with Crown Zellerbach in the paper industry, it just so happens that somebody at that publishing company knew of me from the Crown Zellerbach days. And they reached out to me.
It's all about the network, huh?
Yep. With your background, you know, you'd be a perfect fit to. And at that time, a tech startup, it was taking on three different hats. I was the editor, publisher, and conference director. But that also helped me meet my second goal, is that when I became the conference director, we weren't doing like a one-day conference. These were five consecutive days on three aspects of the nonwovens industry.
Wow.
We had two in the U.S. I did one in Quebec. And then the last year that I was there, we did one in simultaneous translation in Tokyo.
Goal number two accomplished.
Do you believe in like mental exercises, mindset type of work? Do you like brainwash yourself, or are you so focused that you're like, you know, I have a goal, we're just going to make it happen? Or do you have to kind of like talk to yourself and be like, we got this? And
well, again, part of it was from my Levy School of Business background, you know, how to write strategic plans, and then the real experience doing that at that Crown Zellerbach mm-hmm. organization. So, and then having that challenge that I had at the second company where, you know, if we did nothing, we were going to lose a third of our business, and how are we going to replace that? That's where I tried to reassess the situation and change the variables. So I said, well, it's one thing to lose low profitability business, but if we would change our profit margins and bring in business that had greater margins, that would give us more flexibility. And so that was a key element in getting new customers that would pay more. And it was a benefit for them too, because they weren't shipping these containers from the Midwest. They were getting them close to where they're. And that's why we also opened the second operation in Southern California. So we would save freight for them too. So it was not only a good relationship to have them do their R&D with us from a packaging perspective, but they were saving a ton of money on shipping empty containers out from the Midwest compared to something local. That's why the second operation in Southern California made sense.
Yeah, very strategic indeed, for sure. I mean, you've had a pretty exhaustive career. You've done a lot. So we're going to fast forward to what it is that you do now, so we have enough time to talk about all your current projects. So you continue to give back. You do a lot still.
It goes back, Pam, to that experience literally when I was in that situation with the blood clots.
Mm-hmm.
Is that, you know, my sense is that we're here for a purpose. We're here for a certain amount of time. I can't guarantee how long I'll be here, and I can't take it with me. So in terms of helping other people, that to me is something I get a tremendous amount of satisfaction when I'm, you know, particularly during COVID, we had these issues where everything shut down, and people that even were very successful in their business, whether it was a restaurant that they owned or what have you, all of a sudden, no customers, right?
Yeah.
So how do you reassess that? One thing that I started doing was getting involved with this, that time the We're All Human organization had a relationship with Procter & Gamble. So I facilitated a truckload donation that would go to farm workers, an organization called Ayudando Latinos a Sonar in Half Moon Bay. And we were able to split a truckload that was donated, retail value of $500,000, if we could have the entities or the nonprofits pay for the shipping expense. So we split a truckload that was Alas paid for 50% of the shipping cost, and another organization called Celebration Nation, run by Flor Martinez there. She's an amazing individual. So she took the rest of that truckload and shipped them down to, we had delivered to the farm workers in the Salinas Valley.
That's awesome.
So those kind of things, you know, they open other doors, other issues pop up. So it's one thing to say during COVID, you know, the farm workers were still in the field. When it first happened, they didn't even have protective equipment, the masks or anything, while they're still doing that work outside.
Right.
So, you know, getting people to donate to help them do that. And then I was looking at the housing costs here in the Bay Area, in Silicon Valley. It's not unusual to pay $2,000 or more for a one-bedroom apartment, depending on where you're at.
Yeah.
And if a farm worker is making $25,000 maybe at the end of the year, they just can't afford that. So you have two or more families living in a one or two bedroom apartment. That got me looking at the city of Half Moon Bay, where they were located, and found that there was a dormant property that the city owned. It had been empty for 6 years. And so met with the Alas leadership people, the city of Half Moon Bay planners, and talked to the supervisor, Don Horsley, at the time, and came up with this idea. What if we had the city demolish that property? It was a house, a one house next to a community outreach or a community center that the city owned, had them demolish that, and we build a affordable housing facility right there.
How long did it take?
Well, what we did for the first year was we had to get an RFP issued mm-hmm. for the city. We brought on one of the largest affordable housing groups in the country called Mercy Housing. And so Mercy Housing actually was a religious organization when it first started, but they have a strong arm in developing affordable housing. So they were the ones that we partnered with. So there is now an exclusive negotiation agreement in place after that RFP was submitted with Mercy Housing and Ayudando Latinos a Sonar with the city of Half Moon Bay. They're in the stages now of getting CERNA funding. And that to me was the thing that makes this work. So if you're familiar with CERNA funds, is that for the capital that it takes to build this facility, CERNA funds will allow the rental of that property to be at the level that a farm worker that's only making $24,000 or $25,000 a year, they can pay at that level because the capital that was used was obtained using this kind of funding mechanism. It's not for profit. It's not that we're, now that we've got these facilities, we'll charge as much as we can. It's basically flipping that paradigm upside down.
It's possible. That's proof that it's possible.
So that's now it's a $43 million project. It's a five-story facility that it'll take about 4 years to build. But that was one of the things that we featured in the HLX Plus Advocate and Chainmaker Summit, was to say, this is a model. It can be replicated in other locations.
Mm-hmm. Totally. I love that you have various things that you're involved with. How do you take your role in those projects? Because you're such a connector, and you have always been about building networks, like you've just shared, you know, like you got recruited because people knew you and knew about you.
Yeah. So when I retired from AT&T, in the last 10 years there, I was in these, as they were growing by acquisition, building out the e-commerce platform. So I was involved in the metrics and analytics for all the new software. Because, for example, we were the only company outside of Apple selling the iPhones for the first 6 years that they were producing iPhones, right? So from a metric standpoint, as these new offers were offered online for att.com, and then making sure that the stores, the retail stores, were also synced on that same software, that wasn't the way they were designed, because a lot of those stores that were AT&T, those were singular stores before the acquisition. So my work was as you grow by acquisition, all these systems are on the back end are different. So how do you, for example, one of the programs we had to deal with was the software is now getting so fast and they're using these ancient servers. We have to migrate new servers to support the new software. And then coordinating this, I even had people working with me that were software developers writing the code in India so that we could do this 24/7,
wow.
Not just, you know, having people do it 8 hours a day in the US. And then as we made these server changes, oh, guess what? Next week, we're going to have the Apple iPhone launch for this year. So again, trying to coordinate all those logistics, making sure that the code that was there, and it's not just code on your laptop, your operating system, it's Android, it's iPhone, it's laptops, it's desktops, and all those have different coding systems to be, you know, making sure that that code works. So I would also lead after every launch, like a 2 week period of time that we were upgrading or fixing code so that it still would work on whatever device the client had.
How do you find those connections? So for example, the panel that you built, the Asian Latino Cookout in August with Hudson Liao and Robert Hernandez. How did you come up with putting people together to do such thing?
Well, some people know of me. I certainly have known Roberto back in the day when I first started my own consulting group. Because after doing that international business conference, one of the things that became a priority for me is that it wasn't just traveling 3 or 4 days a week and coming home on the weekend. Our son was growing up, and he was at that age where my trips were now 2 weeks away. I was 2 weeks in Europe, or if I was in Japan or another country, it would take me 2 weeks to come back. And I thought, that's not what I want to do. So I left that opportunity and started working again here locally. And when I started my own consulting group, I focused on nonprofits in the Bay Area. And I met Roberto Hernandez, who was at that time doing two things. He had the San Francisco Cinco de Mayo Parade and Festival. And still to this day, he has the Carnival Parade and Festival in May. So if you are familiar with Lent season in Brazil, they have Carnival earlier in the year. Well, because of the weather here, they do that at the Memorial Day weekend. Mm. So I've known Roberto for many, many years. And so I have been in touch with him for the last 2 years. And he had been reaching out, for example, to the Biden administration and talking about the needs of the indigenous people, the Latin people that are in the Mission District in San Francisco, and wanted to get support to deal with some of the funding issues to take care of affordable housing for those people, mm-hmm. and other projects. So fortunately, you know, when I reached out to him to be on this panel that we had in October for our Hispanic Heritage HLX Advocates and Changemakers Summit, he was talking about those plans that they've been working with the Biden administration. And then just about 3 weeks ago, it was announced that they now have a $6 million grant to make affordable housing. So they're doing it at several different levels. So this first phase is land that had been donated by the city and county of San Francisco. That's going to be used to build affordable housing for people in that immediate area. And because of that visibility, and he's also been a long time, you know, when he was a little boy, he learned from Cesar Chavez about organizing. So I was at an event last week. He's announced again, shortly after our HLX Plus Advocate and Changemaker Summit, he's announced he's now running for supervisor for the city and county of San Francisco for the Mission District where he grew up.
That's awesome.
So knowing Roberto, you know, for all those years, he actually had me do the publicity and promotion for the 25th anniversary for the Cinco de Mayo Parade and Festival. I was in the mayor's office taking a picture of Los Lobos when they were performing in the Civic Center. There was about 200,000 people for that event. And then the next day, Linda Ronstadt was the grand marshal for the parade, which was pretty cool as well.
Wow. What's your involvement with HNX Plus? Do you want to talk about that?
Sure. So right now I've got several different roles. I just started this year my own consulting group for having, you know, a positive impact. So I'm president of Argus Associates LLC with CTR Factor. They're a DE&I firm in Tampa. I'm the head of their Latinx and Employee Resource Group practice there. Last night I was at an event thanking the mentors at Santa Clara University, where I got my business law degrees. One of my underclassmate buddies, Jeff Miller, was extremely successful in Silicon Valley and donated $25 million to start the Miller Center for Social Entrepreneurship. Yay. So I've been a mentor there now my fourth year. So we work with entrepreneurs that have a special focus, either helping the environment or helping an area of poverty in the world. So one of the things that, you know, if you're a white Caucasian male in Silicon Valley, that's great. But there's some gaps when you're dealing with a Latina from a South American country or a woman from an African American country. There may be differences in terms of their culture, what's the type of business structure in their country versus how things are done in Silicon Valley. So last year and this year, I with a group of other mentors, we created something called an unconscious bias toolkit with the intention to make them a more effective mentor by going through this process, because everybody's got a bias and they're not aware that they have. We could have a whole hour conversation just talking about the workshop and how we help these mentors understand when you're dealing with somebody from a different background or culture. As you know, one and one is equal to two, it doesn't always come across.
Right.
So we focus on that. So that third role, I'm a mentor with the Miller Center. And then now I'm this Northwest region president for HLX Plus. So I've been in that role for 2 years. We had our first leadership summit hosted by Bill.com. They're a software company in the cloud there in San Jose. And they asked us back this year to do a second conference. And that's where I wanted to change, not just leadership, because there's a lot of leadership conferences during Hispanic Heritage Month, but I'm looking for the people that are advocates and that can change a situation. So that's where we came up with the HLX Plus Advocate and Changemaker Summit. And Roberto was on that panel, as you mentioned, talking about his work that I just outlined in terms of getting grants for affordable housing. But he was also on a panel with Hudson Liao, who's the founder of Asians Are Strong. And Asians are strong here in San Francisco and you know, across the country. Unfortunately, in the last administration, there's a lot of Asian hate that's been started. And unfortunately, here in San Francisco, the largest ethnic community are Asian people. Mm-hmm. And some of these attacks come from behind to seniors, of all things. So Asians are strong. These are people that are giving free self-defense lessons to seniors, Asian seniors there in San Francisco.
That's awesome.
My son got married. The first company that he worked at, one of his buddies, we now call him our second son. He's also part of this Asians Are Strong group. So he introduced Hudson to me. And that's where Hudson's idea was, could we do something? Could I help him find an organization that would collaborate with Asians Are Strong, a cross-culture group in the Mission District where they've got the Hispanic community? So that's where I introduced him to Roberto. And what we were trying to accomplish was to show that culture-wise, food-wise, we're not that different. We have more similarities than people would think. And if we can find a way to work together, that's better than, you know, this Asian hate thing, or how, you know, Hispanics sometimes get, they're looked at as, well, everybody's Mexican. Well, they're, no, they're not. Mm-hmm. And Asians, well, everybody's Asian. Well, they're, are several countries mm-hmm. that are in that area, Japan, Thailand, you know, you can go on and on. But they're looked at as a monolith, and people have certain perceptions about that. So this was a way, from a food perspective and a culture perspective, this was at a, if you can imagine, a lowrider event called the King of the Streets. And when I, you know, heard the word lowrider growing up, you know, well, these are people that lower their cars. But they all now have the capability with the hydraulics to also raise their cars.
To bounce them.
To literally bounce them. So the competition, they had car clubs from around the state, Nevada, come in, and they were competing just to see how high a car can bounce. So talking to Hudson from Asians Are Strong, we had right next door to this area that was set aside for this competition and all the other cars that, even if they weren't competing bouncing a car, these car clubs brought all their lowrider cars up there at Pier 30. Right next to it, we had food trucks, both Hispanic food trucks and Asian food there as well. So you wanted to try ceviche from Peru, there was a food truck there. You wanted to try dim sum, different kinds of things, Chinese, Thai food. They were all there, and it was just amazing to see the entertainment that was. They would have a mariachi group with a singer, and yet they would have the Chinese dragon dancers there and percussion together performing. That's kind of the essence of what went on that day. It was really kind of a, if whether you're Asian or Hispanic, it was just a cool way to see, you know, that much culture all in one place.
I love that. So what's next for Ed Vargas?
Well, with this HLX Plus organization, I was just on a call, actually with a lady named Pam this week, talking about a partnership with a company called P&G or Procter & Gamble. So back when I was with AT&T, pretty large organization, we had 11,000 members just in our ASEMO CRG in 42 cities across the country, Puerto Rico and Mexico City. Those were our employee resource volunteers for ASEMOs. But we also collaborated and partnered with women of AT&T and the other ERGs as well. So what I'd like to see happen with HLX Plus is to align with a strategic plan with Procter & Gamble, because, you know, I was at this Latitude conference in Miami this year, and it was impressive to see the statistics shared by the Latino Donor Collaborative to say we've got about 65 million all Hispanics in the U.S. And if you take a look at that gross domestic product or GDP, that would represent about the fifth largest GDP in the world, Hispanics in the U.S.
We got money to spend.
Exactly. So at Latitude, guess what? It was the CEO of Bank of America, CEO of Wells Fargo was there. New bank that bought out Bank of the West, BMO, they were there. And they want to align themselves with, you know, the Hispanic community. And it's not just, it's like if you're in the U.S., you know, here we are, you and I are on the West Coast, but it's a lot different than if you go to Alabama or Georgia or the New England states. You know, we all have regional preferences, right? We're all human beings, but again, you know, there are those kind of distinctions. And so that to me, like we had with the ASEMOS organization, I hope to see HLX Plus as a network that can reach all Hispanics in the U.S. and open doors, whether they're an entrepreneur, whether they're, you know, starting their own business, education for kids. That's something that's been important to me for many, many years with starting High Tech Day there at AT&T. I'm now also a mentor with the Guillermo Diaz Jr. has this Conectado.com metaverse platform. And he now has his second bioinformatics bootcamp that's a partnership with Accenture and Stanford Medical Center. So the first bootcamp that we had in that area was, I think, 15 students, high school students, early college students, learning how to code, you know, just like if you have your Fitbit or your Apple Watch, you know, those are bioinformatics. So learning how to code for products and devices in that growing tech area.
That's important work.
And so now with this current cohort, we've got 45 students. So it's an opportunity for them to not only get this to look at a tech career, but put them in the driver's seat, just like I had in this idea of sharing their college career strategic planning tool. Okay, so now that you've got this education, what are you going to do with it? How is that going to help you? How is it going to help your community? So that's how I speak to these kids. It's not just the education and the knowledge of knowing how to do this code, but where do you see yourself? What do you want to do with that knowledge? That's how I'm talking to this. So, for example, the lady that I've got as a mentee for me, she's not a high school student. She's already got a family. And one of the things for her is that she just found that her daughter has autism. So rather than working at a facility, you know, being a healthcare provider, she sees value in spending more time with her daughter. So she wants to become a remote worker. And from the standpoint of this kind of knowledge, she could do this kind of coding at home, for example. So I'm telling her, okay, if that's what you want to do, let's think through that. You know, make sure that, you know, it's not just taking, hey, I can make this much an hour doing this kind of tech work. It's like if you're going to have truly, you know, a long-term issue with your daughter's health, make sure that you've got benefits covered in that package that you're going to take a look at, and be selective. Don't just take the first job because it's a well-paying job. Kind of look at it from a longer-term perspective. So I'm working with her right now. I just had our first meeting last Friday. I've got our second meeting tomorrow with her as well. So to answer your question, you know, from my perspective, it's like I try to use the knowledge and experience that I have in as many ways as I can to help people get through challenges that they may have.
For sure. Ed Vargas didn't come to play, everyone. I love this. Your work is awesome and so needed. And I'm glad you are still doing it and continue to do it and changing lives all along. So Ed, where can we find you? Tell us all the places and spaces where if people want to connect with you, what would be a way to connect?
Best way people to reach me would be through LinkedIn. And I even, if people are in the Bay Area and they need a sit-in lead guitar player, I still even have my openroadband.com website up so they can see the songs that I've played. And that comes up occasionally. I was approached by a lady and her husband who they do fundraisers for schools in Marin County. And their lead guitar player, unfortunately, his mom had passed. So they had a commitment. They needed to get somebody to sit in for him. And he's just a great guy, too. So the music that they were playing for this one event was, if you can imagine, there's this type of genre called yacht rock.
Okay.
So it was Hall & Oates and some of these laid-back things, you know, Ride Like the Wind, that artist, you know, those kinds of songs. So they asked me, you know, if I could sit in for their guitar player and perform that. So some of these songs I've already known, so I was able to, within less than 2 weeks, I was able to get up to speed with the way with their song list was going to be for that event, and it worked out well.
That's so fun. So, Ed, we have three more questions to ask. One, do you have a remedy that you want to share with us?
As a lifelong musician, I first thought about how I feel. So when I was in that role of, you know, trying to make a new client customer of mine, I would always listen to my favorite music to kind of get my energy up. But as a musician to play, it's also very calming. If I'm learning or listening to songs that I love, it relaxes me. So that's one thing that I would recommend to anybody. If you want to learn how to play an instrument, there's another level of satisfaction that feels good if you're playing with other musicians at that same level and you're in the groove, so to speak.
For sure. I could see that.
But what's most exciting to me, and even people will pay tickets to go see a great live band, that energy with a performing live in front of a live audience. I don't have to ask people to get up and dance. They grab somebody and get on the dance floor. And it doesn't matter. You could be a CEO. You could be a janitor. You're on the dance floor because you're in the moment. So having that opportunity to be a musician, to play for a special audience and just make it a special memory that they'll never forget, that is so cool from my perspective. Some of the things that I'm still dealing with from playing football, some of those things, okay, my back and my knee and my shoulders, I would also recommend a lady named Carmen Milagro. She's an entrepreneur. She's our director of health and wellness for our HLX Plus group here. And she's actually in San Diego this week. She was speaking at the Association for Naval Service Officers with Roy Love. They had their conference hosted by the San Diego chapter for ANSO. And she was speaking to them about for those veterans that are that have come back from action and they're looking to assimilate back here and into our culture. If they need help or they want to become a coach to help others, she was giving them a lecture on how to become a coach.
Oh, I love that.
And that's also with our partner. We're trying to get an MOU in place with HLX Plus and Expandy TV. So the lady, Camille Garrett, that was up at our summit, also on the same panel with Carmen. Carmen is there this week in San Diego talking to that audience. And she not only, you know, does a great job coaching from that perspective, but if you could check out the website wellnessbydivina.com, and Divina is D-I-V-I-N-A. wellnessbydivina.com. Something that has really helped me is that she's got a bioresonance frequency soothe massage and muscle serum. So wow. Something like you're using, you have a weakness or something sore. I've put that on and rubbed it. And over a period of time, it really has helped take that pressure or those pain points away. So it's a massage and muscle serum. I highly recommend that.
Perfect. All these endorsements, they need to come and sponsor us one day and come get an interview too, because they sound like awesome people. Do you have a quote or mantra that you live by?
What I would recommend to people is be the change you want to see. That to me is what's driven me to not only go to law school, represent people in the situation with farm workers, find affordable housing for them, is that if no one's doing it and you want to make a change, you can be that change maker.
I agree.
Be the change you want to see.
I support that. And last but not least, do you have a productivity tip, trick, or tool that you want to share with us?
Well, I did share, and I would highly recommend. I use it in two ways. It's what I call it is the college and career strategic planning tool. Mm-hmm. So I first developed that, taking some of the group business practice things that I got from not only, you know, the Levy School of Business at Santa Clara, but experience as a group planner in Crown Zellerbach. But I modified it to help high school students like myself. You know, I didn't have anybody else in my family going to college. You know, what's that like? How do I deal with that? It's not just going to class and turning the test in. It's the lifestyle. It's, you know, how do you spend your time?
Totally.
Where do you prioritize things? So helping them think through 5 years from now, what do you want to do with that education? What do you want to do? What do you want to be? So I've shared that with you. I'm happy to have you put that up for people to take a look at. It's actually on my LinkedIn profile as well. People can download it from there. But to me, it's a great opportunity for younger people as well as people coming back. Like I mentioned earlier, the Association for Naval Service Officers, you've got people that, unfortunately, there's a high suicide rate for military people coming back after that experience and coming back and not finding things the way they remember and having that experience being in those difficult situations, putting their life on the line. They need some support and direction. And I've also used that with people in that situation as well. So it's a good tool to kind of help people get their thoughts in order.
For sure. Yeah, we'll drop it in the show notes. And for those of you who may be tuning in on YouTube, you will have it in the notes, in the episode notes. So you can go into the description and then click on the links to get there. Well, Mr. Ed, thank you so much for coming to Café con Pam. This was super fun. We could talk for hours.
Pam, I'm looking forward to the next time we get a chance together in person or a Café con Pam.
Yay.
Stay shining.
All right, listeners, that was my conversation with Ed Vargas. I am so curious to know your thoughts. Of course, Ed has such a rich life and so full of stories and various intricate lines and different ways that he has experienced in his journey that we literally could have gone hours on end talking about all the things that he's lived. But I really enjoy his passion for always bringing the community with him. I think that's one of the things that really resonates from Ed's passion is making sure things are done right. And when I speak to people that think very linearly, like Ed does, it's really fascinating for me to, with my ADHD, to follow like the many layers that come within the story and how I, you know, ask questions that sometimes are not following the timeline. And so I find it fascinating how that could sometimes throw people off and then they bring themselves back to like, wait, this is actually what I was talking about. So we're going to continue that thread. I really enjoyed kind of like witnessing it from that end because I have a lot of awareness of how I think and how much non-linearity I bring to the table. I'm hyper aware of that. I've had to deal with it all my life. And so it's something that I'm super aware. And I've also deliberately now not mask, especially on the podcast, which I think in a way I also attract people that can follow those types of conversations as a listener. And those of you who have perhaps left little stars or not vibed so much with my questions is because they might be a little too sporadic for you, which it's fine, totally fine. But this conversation specifically was one that I was hyper aware of my nonlinear way of asking questions and how someone who's used to having linear thinking, the responses were clear of how a brain like that thinks. It's fascinating. It's fascinating. But I want to, listeners, I really hope you enjoyed it. I hope it was fruitful, inspiring, motivating you to take action and to really keep going. And to, again, to always believe and do what is right. Because doing what's right is one thing and knowing what's right is another thing. I really hope Ed's story inspires you to do that. It went out. If this is your first time here, welcome to Café con Pam. I hope you stay. Grab a chair, grab a couch, whatever it is that you feel called to grab. And I hope you return A great way to do so is to follow. Click that follow button, click the subscribe, click the whatever it is on whichever podcast platform you use. Apple Podcasts and Spotify are the two most popular ones that follow that our listeners use. And so if you're in one of those, we also appreciate stars. If that is something that you feel called to dropping, it's really useful because other people that might be interested in listening, once they see your stars and your reviews, they can actually get a glimpse or a feel of what to expect with the show. And so I really appreciate it if you take the time, you know, 2-3 minutes extra to drop some thoughts. It means a lot to us. It's a great way to support the show, to support the fact that this is free content for you. Yes, we do have some ads, and otherwise we wouldn't be able to sustain ourselves because, you know, there's a team behind it that needs to eat and pay bills. And so your reviews are a great way to support us. I appreciate it so much. And thank you for being here. Y bueno, I would love to stay connected at Café con Pan Podcast on Instagram and Facebook, at Café con Pan Pod on TikTok. La página is just cafeconpan.com. Very simple. You can arrive there, check it out. Not only will you be able to see the episode notes for this episode, but also you'll be able to read articles in our pour over section. So we have started to write articles and feature other awesome people that may not, for various reasons, make it to the show, but they can still, we're offering pour over interviews. Many times is because, like, we get a lot of people reaching out because they're authors, for example, and they're like, yeah, my book comes out tomorrow. And I'm like, yeah, no, we have interviews booked for right now. I'm recording this in December. We are booking March, I think, at this point. And so many times, that's one big reason why we started the pour over, because we wanted to make sure that people still got their story out, and the pour over is a much faster way of making it happen. Coming soon in 2024, I'll share a little glimpse of what we are looking forward to. We are going to be starting to share more remedios. We are going to start focusing a lot more on video. I'm doing the Café con Pan tour in San Diego, where we are visiting local restaurants and coffee shops mainly, and interviewing the founders about their story and their coffee shop. And I'm doing that in person, which is super fun. And this is in partnership with Nomono. Nomono is a sound capsule, beautiful product. I love it. I love my Nomono. It's like amazing. And because of them, because of this partnership, I'm able to do this in IRL. I'm able to travel to locations and record these episodes for you. So I can't wait for you to check them out on the YouTube. And on YouTube, we just search for Café con Pan. Make sure you subscribe and push the bell so you know when we drop new episodes and new videos. Whoa, this is almost the last episode of 2023. Not quite, but we're getting there. We have two more episodes left of 2023, and we are still here. And I want to thank you so much for being here throughout the years. We celebrated 7 years this year, and it's pretty awesome. I'm so grateful for you. Y como siempre, stay shining.